From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Bruce Feiler has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, and Gourmet, where he won 3 James Beard Awards. He is also a frequent contributor to NPR, CNN, and Fox. He's the author of 9 books, among them Walking the Bible, A Journey on Land Through the 5 Books of Moses, Dreaming Out Loud, Garth Brooks, Winona Judd, Wade Hayes, and The Changing Face of Nashville, and Under the Big Top, A Season with the Circus. His latest is 2009's America's Prophet, Moses and the American Story. He is in Columbus as a Thurber House author, and I once again recommend checking their website at thurberhouse.org for visiting authors. Welcome to Writer's Talk.
Thank you very much. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start on how you got interested in this book. After you traveled the world for Walking the Bible, you came back to the U.S. and ran into a number of Moses references, right, on a tour of the Mayflower Tour, Mayflower 2, on the Liberty Bell. From Washington's first week as president, there are some things that he's written that invoked Moses. Tell me about the moment when you decided that Moses would be the subject of your new book.
Well, as you've just said in this very generous introduction, I actually had spent most of my writing life kind of traveling around, entering different subcultures, Japan, England, country music, the circus. And then I had spent 10 years of my life basically retracing the Bible through the desert. And in fact, when I first had the idea to walk the Bible, I thought, oh, I'll join the Bible as if it were the circus and seek to become a part of it. And so that was 10 years and 3 different books. I climbed Mount Ararat looking for Noah's Ark, crossed the Red Sea, climbed Mount Sinai, later hosted a television show on PBS called Walking the Bible. And you know, a lot of that conversation was about this relationship between religion and politics, which seemed to be, at the time, headquartered in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Then I started spending more time at home. My wife gave birth to identical twin daughters, as you. And as you said, we started traveling around. We went to visit my in-laws in Boston. I went on board the Mayflower, and there was a reenactor reading the Bible. And I said, well, I'm a Bible guy. What are you reading? And he said, the Exodus. We read it on the Atlantic. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Here's Moses in the middle of the American Thanksgiving story. Mm-hmm. In Savannah, there's a letter from George Washington, in which he credits his success in the Revolution to the same God who freed the Hebrews from Egypt. And I thought, okay, well, here's Moses in the middle of the Revolution. And then I kept encountering the story over and over again. A quote from Moses on the Liberty Bell. Ben Franklin recruiting Moses to pass the Constitution. Harriet Tubman on the Underground Railroad, which ran in some ways right through where we're sitting right now, calling herself the Moses of her people. Martin Luther King, of course, the night before he died. Nearly every president, Reagan, Bush, Barack
Especially
Obama.
Especially Lincoln, we'll write about it here.
And of course, Lincoln, who also came through Ohio, were connected to this story. And I was stunned by this. I mean, I was an American history major in college. No one ever mentioned this story to me. But I now believe that for 400 years, one figure is the surprising symbol of America. One man is our real founding father. His name is Moses. And I would tell his story. Go forth, as I like to do, travel, enter these various worlds, and come back and see why is it that this story has inspired so many Americans, and in an age when we all can't talk to one another because of all the conflicts that occur around Thanksgiving tables, for example. If Moses could split the Red Sea, could he unsplit America?
Okay. So how did that happen? I mean, like you said, you've got all these disparate times when you're seeing Moses. When did it really start to hit home for you? How many times did you hit it before you said, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to write this book? And how did that, I'm just curious, from a writer's standpoint, right. You've already done Walking the Bible, so you don't want to be pigeonholed as the Bible guy, but maybe you're looking forward to being the Bible guy. What's the decision-making process for a writer to look at all these things, and when did it really start to gel in your mind? You've got a couple of things that are these weird coincidences, but how does it happen after that?
Well, as a writer, I am an experientialist, okay? I mean, there are different ways of approaching a kind of, so you can do it from an academic point of view, you can go to the library and do lots of research, you can do it from a memoir point of view, there's lots of different ways you can do it. My personal process is I'm an experientialist. I'm a joiner. I like to go out and to travel. And so the kind of way I work is, let's say, a year of research where I read, before walking the Bible, 150 books about the Bible in the case of America's Prophet, spend a period of time just convincing myself that it was actually there in enough places to be sustainable, as opposed to just a few isolated incidents, that thematically you can sustain it. So, and what I personally look for, again, from a pure writing point of view, is I look for a big question. Mm-hmm. Okay, what can you learn about the Bible by retracing it through the desert? Okay, what can you learn about 9/11 and this moment of can the religions get along by looking at the figure of Abraham, who's the shared ancestor of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, from my book called Abraham? What can you learn about America from traveling around with Garth Brooks for a year, and why suddenly country music, which used to be a niche world, is now a broad world? And in this case, it was, you know, why is it that this story has inspired so many people? What does it say about America that this 3,000-year-old story of people in oppression, in slavery, feeling constricted, could come out of that difficult place, imagine a promised land, and then set forth to try to make that promised land come true? And then what I need is I need a journey. I need a kind of a narrative mm-hmm. crucible. So a kind of experience I could have. So it was, first of all, convincing it myself it was enough places. And when I found it in the Pilgrims, and I found it in Martin Luther King, and I found it in the Liberty Bell, and I found it at the Statue of Liberty, I'm
that
beginning to think, yeah, exactly. Okay, that's enough. I don't know what I'm going to find, but I'm going to, you know, almost like a novelist, I'm going to go in and I'll find it enough places. And I need things that I can do. Mm-hmm. So in this case, sail on Plymouth Harbor, climb the Bell Tower of Independence Hall, ultimately go into, after a long application process, Cecil B. DeMille's garage to try on Charlton Heston's robe.
Which fits, happily enough for you. It turns out you were right about the right size as Charlton Heston in the book.
If it were Tom Cruise and he's like 5'2", at 6'2", it turns out I'm the size of Heston. You know, and then I had to decide, do I spread my arms? Behold his mighty hand. But that, by the way, this, I would say the Heston moment, a key moment in this whole process, because it was realizing that DeMille, in 1956, turned Moses into an icon of the Cold War and used lots of kind of communist imagery. That was one of the key moments. I would think, okay, well, here's a Hollywood movie that's actually designed to send messages, a political message. You have a 3-hour 39-minute movie, and DeMille felt the need for a 5-minute preamble in which he stands there and he says, this is what this movie's about. It's about communism. If you live under a dictatorship, you can't worship freely. If you live in a, you know, in a democracy, you can worship God's will. And all the way down through the plagues, he did 3 plagues, turning the Nile into blood, which he used a garden hose, hail, which, as you know, because you've read the book, he uses popcorn. And everyone guesses mothballs, but they break. Popcorn's easy to sweep up.
It's also the smell. If you're using mothballs, it must smell horrible on the set as well.
Right, but then you have the opposite problem with the popcorn. You want to eat the hail. Everyone's sticking her tongue out or something. But then, what was the scariest thing in 56 America? Answer: nuclear war. This is the duck and cover age. So he uses this green fog that comes over the horizon and seeps under. And then the last scene of the movie, as you know, I mean, he has Moses go to the top of Mount Nebo, hand over the Book of Life to Joshua, his successor, turn, quote, the Liberty Bell, proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants. So that's in the book of Leviticus, 3 books earlier, not the end of Deuteronomy, then turns and recreates the pose of the Statue of Liberty. And the Statue of Liberty spikes around her head, tablet in her arms, both from this moment Moses comes down Sinai with the Ten Commandments. DeMille walks Moses through this great litany of American icons until he becomes the embodiment of America enlightening the world.
Okay. So how much, when you've gone out to talk to people about this, I watched a YouTube interview that you did, and there was some disagreement about the premise.
Yeah.
Have you had a lot of disagreements, what has the reaction been so far to the contention of Moses as one of the founding fathers? And you even say on Mount Rushmore,
yeah,
he should be on that.
Yeah,
how's
Moses
that?
He should be on Mount Rushmore. I think that it is a startling idea to people, because people don't associate this story with America. I would say that the critical reaction has been, what a strange idea, but oh my gosh, here it is. It's convincing. I mean, when you actually look at that, I did worry. You talk about the writerly process, right? I did worry could I prove it? But I would say very early on, I realized I wasn't going to prove it. I was going to overprove it. And in fact, I had to make it entertaining. But you think of, you know, we talked about the Underground Railroad. I mean, the X's was the dominant theme from all of these slave spirituals. Take back Pharaoh's army, bound for the land of Canaan, go down Moses. It was called the national anthem of slaves. I mean, right through the story has been used. And so I think that while the idea is startling to people, I would say that the book is making the case. And so I do think that this idea is going to be out there and people are going to grapple with it. And as a writer, that's an amazing thing to have happen, to have people take the idea seriously and then debate it. I'm perfectly happy for them to debate it.
Okay. Now, you spent 2 years writing this book, right?
More or less, 2-3 years, something like that.
Because what are your writing habits? You go out, you read a bunch of books to find evidence and / convince yourself it's true.
Yeah.
And then you take, what, copious notes on a laptop or something. I'm curious what the actual way that you approach a book over that's going to be that long, because it's a dissertation kind of thing. And you've got a ton of books in here that you're citing. So tell me how that all works.
Well, I think, from a writer's point of view, there are different stages. So stage one is a kind of reading stage. And I've done this now long enough. This was my eighth book. I've actually written a book subsequent to that. I've done enough so that I can keep an outline in my head. So I kind of know going in. So I tend to take notes in a very targeted way. So rather than the old way that I was taught when I was in college of the note cards, I'm taking notes and putting them kind of where they're going to go in the book. So there's a research phase. Round numbers, a year of research, a year of travel, a year of writing, and then if you're lucky, a year of talking about it. So there is that research phase. And then I go out into the field, and then I do lots of different things. I take notes. I do tape interviews. I then will often come back after a day and kind of just write raw notes to myself. In my kind of initial impressions. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years now, and I found at the beginning, from the very beginning, I was kind of okay at describing scenes. I kind of go into a sort of hypersensitive mode where I can pick up what it feels like to be in a room. In some ways, I think that's a kind of a core skill of mine, to go into a room. At this point, I think almost anywhere in the world, come out and tell you what it's like to be in that room. But I found I had weaknesses too. Dialogue was an original weakness of mine. So I spend a lot of time trying to hear the way people talk, so that when you have, say in this book, 40 or 50 people interviewed, I don't want them all to sound alike. They need to have some...
But you don't just go back for the tapes for that. You do something else in terms of dialogue for that. I mean, what's your...
No, I do go back to the tape, but I also do more than that. I mean, I also try to... I read a friend's book, I have to say, recently, who would describe people, and the descriptions would go on for like a page and a half of the people, and I'm like, it's too much. I don't need the eyes and the ears and the head and the hair and the clothes and the vibe. It's like from a writer point, I feel like you should be able to describe somebody, in 4 or 5 things and capture what it is about them that's distinctive, so there can be and it's the same thing in the voice. I really try to kind of get the voice. The words can do that, but somehow there are other things to kind of capture a sort of pace, a pace of exchange, to kind of make it come to life on the page.
Okay. And so you do these, you do the research, and then you come back and do the writing. Which is your favorite? What do you really enjoy about the writing process? Is it, I think for you, a lot of it is getting out into the field and, walking the desert or something horrendous like that. Tony Horowitz was here, and he talked about, going out and finding things that are very difficult to live through, like a sweat lodge ceremony. And that seemed to me to be a particular kind of masochism that writers occasionally share. I'll go to the desert, I'll climb a mountain, So what is it that you really enjoy about the writing process?
Well, Tony, of course, Tony is a buddy of mine and of long standing, and he has a kind of... he has a kind of wit and a way of turning around, mm-hmm. you know, of bringing a kind of humor and distance and archness and cleverness to his encounters. I made a television show of Walking the Bible, as you know, and the director had a really great phrase for when we would be out in the desert and we were doing one of the things, whether it be tasting manna or climbing Mount Sinai or walking in a church or whatever we were doing. And he would say, you know, you need a bit of business. You need a bit of business on the screen so that the people are not just sitting around talking to one another, right? Mm-hmm. So that there's something active. And I do think that there is a certain amount of that. I mean, I like, it's a way I grew up in the age of discount airfare. So this idea of going to places and, you know, entering different worlds, you know, I think of myself as not particularly interesting, but I do interesting things. So I can't really make it up. And when you go out and, you know, I was in the circus for a year and we had, you know, murder, rape, arson, bigamy, bestiality, group sex, organized crime. I mean, I called them the seven circus sins.
I got the Moses book. Exactly. I'm feeling a little left out here.
The point is, you put yourself, I mean, the circus is a great analogy. I was in the circus for a year, right? 99 cities, 501 performances, two shows a day, 7 days a week, three shows on Saturday. I now believe if I put myself in something, sooner or later, something will happen. It's not always when you want it or need it, but if I go out there and I climb the mountain or I cross the desert or I climb, retrace the Underground Railroad down in Ripley or go into Cecil B. DeMille's garage or sail on Plymouth Harbor or stand where Martin Luther King stood or go to the Oval Office, if I put myself in enough situations, something interesting will happen. So to your question, I'm kind of a freak in the sense that I enjoy all the I actually like the reading. I'm both a very people person, gregarious kind of person, but I also like the solitude. So I like the reading. I certainly like the traveling. And I also like the writing. That sense of creating something on the page is incredibly satisfying to me.
You know, I'm curious about that because you talk about participatory journalism, and the next book that you've written, I think you're maybe done writing. I think it's coming out January 2010.
April.
Okay, is about fatherhood.
Yes,
the ultimate participatory journalism. How is that different? You know, you do the research. You've read presumably before about having children.
That book is the real story about that book, at the risk of taking the smile off your face, is that 15 months before I'm sitting here with you now, I was diagnosed with bone cancer. Mm-hmm. I had a 7-inch tumor in my left femur. It's an incredibly rare cancer I had. It probably got there because I was in a bike accident when I was 5. Mm-hmm. And for whatever set of reasons, I broke my femur in that place, and for whatever set of reasons, 38 years later, it cancerified. So suddenly I was the walking guy who faced the very real prospect of never being able to walk again. So as I, in those very early painful days, I had a whole series of cascading reactions. I thought, you know what? I'm at peace. I've lived a full life. At the time I'd written 8 books. I thought that my wife, whatever pain she would endure, would find a way to live a life of passion. But I came back to my daughters, who at the time were 3 years old, and would they lack for my approval or my discipline or my voice? And I came up with a way to give them that voice. I reached out to 6 men from all parts of my life and asked them to be present through the passages of my daughters' lives. And I call this group of men the Council of Dads. So the book I've written is called The Council of Dads, My Daughters, My Illness, and the Man Who Could Be Me. And it is a description. It's a series of letters that I wrote chronicling what happened to me as I had a year of chemotherapy and 15-hour reconstructive surgery in which my femur was removed, replaced with titanium. My fibula was put into my calf, and a third of my thigh muscle was removed. And then I went back in for more chemo. So it's a chronicle of this lost year. It's portraits of these men and the life lessons I want them to embody. And in this case, portraits of me, my father, my grandfathers, various father figures. As a friend of mine who read it recently mentioned, I normally write travel books to places that you want to go. This is a travel book to a place you don't want to go. Yeah. So it was participatory in the deepest sense of the word, but it's a very uplifting book with a kind of very profound series of messages from my daughters.
That must be a lot more difficult? Was it? Did you find it to be a far more difficult book to write? It sounds, you know, I mean, you've got all the other things going on, but just sitting down to write that, to me, you have to go over and over it. And you have to go over it, not only on the factual level, but also on the emotional level. And then there's the detached sort of critic of yourself saying, you know what, I didn't describe that very well.
Well, it fell off my fingers. I mean, it was the ninth book I've written. This book took 3 years. That book took 3 months. Mm-hmm. The letters were already done. I didn't obviously start it till I was through the end of the year. But the rest of it, I've just never had this experience. And the reaction already, it's not even published, but just showing it around, is bigger than everything I've written put together. It was a kind of confluence of a lot of craft and a lot of very, very deeply felt emotions. So I think that the emotions were so real. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a writing teacher, I describe writing in a lot of ways as putting arrows in a quiver, which are different techniques that you have at your disposal so that when you're in the underbrush and you're under assault, you have a number of weapons that you can pull out. I mean, so I don't think of writing, I don't sit down to write a book. I take an idea, I break it into sections, I break it into chapters, I break it into paragraphs, I break it into sentences. And so I think of it as a series of problems you got to get through. And so I think of writing as, you know, you're halfway through a paragraph and you're stuck. How do you get out? And fortunately now, after 20 years, I got a number of tricks at my disposal to get myself out. So that's why I think of those arrows are. So when I'm stuck, I can get out of the underbrush, if you will. And so I think that by the time I got to the Council of Dads, I have a lot of quivers. I got a lot of arrows in my quiver. And in this case, if clear writing is clear thinking, I knew exactly what was on my mind. I knew exactly what I wanted to communicate. I knew exactly who I was writing for. So it did just come out. But yes, you then have to be a critic. And when I read the opening chapter of my book, when I go through the series of tests that run into the diagnosis, I'm like, don't go in that room. You know, don't take that test. Every time I read it, I'm like, don't go there. Don't go there. Oh, darn, he got cancer again.
It's also interesting. I mean, it's a great analogy for having the quivers in the arrows in the quiver.
But I'm messing up my own analogy and repeating the mess up.
For quivering, But it's also sort of it suggests a certain violence in writing because you're shooting something.
Yes.
You know, you're getting out of the underbrush, but you're getting out of the underbrush by using this sort of offensive weapon.
Yes.
I think that's really interesting from a viewpoint of what does that say about audience?
Yes.
You're aiming at the audience in some way.
Well, or you're aiming at your heart. I don't know about you, but I definitely have a very interactive relationship with my computer screen when I'm writing. I mean, I'll go, yes, or I'll go, ugh, you know, and I will, and in fact, I sat down to write the Council of Dads ends with a letter from me to my daughters, in which I've said, in the worst case scenario, I've left this behind. And in every other book I've written, like America's Prophet, I would gather notes for the conclusion all the way along, just to kind of, whenever I had a big idea, I'd kind of stick it in a, for the big ideas at the end of the book file.
Right.
And I didn't do that with the Council of Dads. I almost didn't want to write the ending because I knew it would be so raw, this letter to my daughters. And then I sat down and said, okay, the next week I'm going to begin to write this letter. I think I sat down at 7 o'clock on a Friday night, and by 9:30 the whole thing was out of me. And my wife came in, and I'm just a wreck. I mean, and she's like, did you just write the last chapter of your book? Because I'm definitely going there. Somebody told me, a writer I met very early on in my life, I think before I'd even written a book, had said to me, you know, if your own writing doesn't turn you on, and he was talking about a certain kind of writing, but if your own writing doesn't turn you on, then it's really not any good. And so I think it's violent sometimes. Sometimes you're making love to the screen, and sometimes you're angry at it, and sometimes you're really broken up by it.
Now,
it's
a good sign. You work in a room, you say in the book, that shares a wall with your daughters.
Yes.
Do they ever say, Dad, quit writing, we can't sleep, you're yelling at the screen too much?
Yeah, that's funny that you say that. I actually, this sound kind of quasi-soundproof the room. Now, I have to say, I work at home, and I know different writers feel differently about this. I don't actually mind the interruptions. I mean, if I'm home, I'm working, and the great pleasure is my kids come home from school. They're four now. I can go down and not wrestle with them because they're girls, but I can, you know, hang out with them for an hour. I can go down and have lunch and then come back. And I feared this sort of, Daddy, why don't you come out to play thing. But it never really happened. In fact, my girls are very verbal, and they like to come in, and I have on my computer screen like a thesaurus, online thesaurus, and look, rhyming dictionaries, and they like coming in and playing, can we play thesaurus? Can we play rhyming dictionary? So, you know, and I knew I was in trouble when they asked me, they said, what is terrific Tuesday and super Saturday. I'm like, oh, what's a kind of rhyme? They're like, well, no rhymes. You sound alike. And I had to explain to my three-year-olds what alliteration was. And
right.
I realized, okay.
You're not worried that you're dooming them to a life of writing.
I know, right? That would be, yeah. That's a little terrifying. Although I have to say, as a writer, you can tell. I have the identical twins. Mm-hmm. One of them is like me, and one of them is like my wife in one regard, which is that one is incredibly observant, and the other doesn't notice anything. My daughter Tybee, my daughter Eden, I have two pictures of them on the room in my room, and one of them fell over, and my wife could come in for 2 months. She wouldn't notice it. Tybee walks in the middle of the night, she's like, something fell over. If there's something new, she can pick, whatever that thing mm-hmm. is, that observant gene, she's got it. My other one, she's just much more interested in herself, so she doesn't, but it's not on her, she doesn't notice it.
It wasn't the picture of her that fell over.
Well, exactly, but in general, she doesn't, my other one, she's the one who's always saying interesting things.
Okay. Well, I want to switch gears just a little bit in the time that we've got left to ask you about the PBS documentary you made for Walking the Bible. Yeah. Tell me about the script for that. Did you have a hand in developing that? Because that's a different kind of writing.
Very interesting question, because I think from a writing point of view, so the basic idea of Walking the Bible was I hadn't read the Bible since I was a kid. I felt like a writer. I should be more conversant. Mm-hmm. Every day you hear, you know, David and Goliath or Samson or right. Solomon's baby or Adam and Eve. And I thought, you know what? I should read the Bible. I put it by my bed. It sat there untouched for 2 years. The Bible does not invite you in, really. It's very distant in a lot of ways. And then I went to visit an old friend. I went to in Jerusalem. I went on a tour. My friend said, over there is a controversial neighborhood. Over there is the rock where Abraham went to sacrifice Isaac. I thought, wow, these are real places. I'll just, you know, retrace the Bible and read the stories along the way. The arc that book ended up having from a writer's point of view is I kind of went in seeking science. The actual rock, the actual body of water, the actual mountain, but learned all of that, went through it, and became much more interested in meaning. So the challenge from the TV show was, do I recreate that arc, mm-hmm. even though it was 5 years earlier, or do I begin as the person I was at the end? And initially I made the mistake. I thought that arc was so clear, I should recreate it, which put me in the position of being inauthentic, and I'm not good enough as a performer to do that, and it just the camera picks it up. So I basically then had to kind of undo what we had done in the early days and go back and be myself today mm-hmm. and re-experience the places.
So by that you mean rewriting the script or doing something different with
it wasn't the script. What they did was they kind of blocked it out, but there wasn't a lot of the script. There's times when I kind of look directly into the camera and expression or mm-hmm. of what I'm feeling or thinking at the moment.
Right.
But, and by the way, and I would basically say, okay, now it's time for one of those. And I'd go kind of walk in a circle and kind of script it in my head and then do it mm-hmm. relatively live. So it wasn't that scripted. The problem was the first time they did, I looked into the camera and, you know, I spoke for 4 or 5 minutes and they're like, okay, nobody wants to look at you for more than 1 minute and 38 seconds. So it became a thing that they would only let me talk for 1 minute and 38 seconds. So now,
it's a very specific time.
Incredibly specific.
That, yeah.
And I don't know if they tested my face and that's as long as people want to look at me. But now if you told me to speak now for 1 minute and 38 seconds, I can hit it almost to the second.
Excellent. Well, and so this, do you feel different as a writer now that you've done that? I'm just curious. And then this is going to have to be like a minute and a half answer. Does that change having to write that stuff on the spot and redo it for the television? I'm curious if that changes you as a writer in ways that you couldn't do that before.
It has to be very simple for television. Mm-hmm. Television's good at very big ideas, and it's good at very specific things. So all the middle stuff, the attempt to prove it, has to go away. Give them a big idea and give them one example and then move on. But the biggest difference, I would say, is that as a speaker, you have to be big to a room. Whereas on television, you, as you know better than me, you have to channel that energy in a different way. So I would say it was more about energy distribution was the biggest change, okay. not really as a writer.
Okay. Well, Bruce Feiler has written America's Prophet, and it is out and available now. If you miss him at the Thurber House, please check out their upcoming authors at thurberhouse.org. You can check out his book at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at everywhere.
BruceFeiler.com.
BruceFeiler.com. And thank you very much for coming today.
As Bruce said, brucefeiler.com is a good place to learn more, and you can get there by visiting writerstalk.org. And while you're on the writerstalk.org website, be sure to follow the links to the Digital Media in a Social World conference. It'll be held February 19th and 20th at The Ohio State University, and it will feature all manner of interesting talks about new media, digital media, and social media, all kinds of media. You'll be pleased to meet everybody there. Join us next time for 60 Minutes correspondent Byron Pitts, author of Step Out on Nothing, How Faith and Family Helped Me Conquer Life's Challenges. Until then, from The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dangler saying, keep writing, and
Happy New Year!